Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you from the Rocky Mountain town of Crested Butte, Colorado. I am your host, Mark Troutman, CFP. This educational, personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. Welcome to today's show. I thought I would do something a little different. I'm calling it Mark's Money Mind Monthly Mailbag. I've been getting a number of emails from listeners. Thank you for sending those in. And I wanted to reply or respond to a few of them on today's show. If you recall in episode 15, which was the phases of financial freedom, we talked about that middle phase, which some people have referred to as the boring middle or mucky middle. And I'd asked people to send in some suggestions for a better name. And I got a number of emails. Thank you very much for sending them in. But one really stood out to me, and I will read that to you. And this is from Ryan. And as you will see, Ryan and I have, our paths have crossed in the past. And I will talk a little bit about that after I read his email. It says, "Hey, Mark, I hope you're doing well. We only interacted a couple of times at the retreat in Bali, but it's nice hearing your voice again on your new podcast. I'm listening to episode 15 and really like the theme you discussed. I totally agree with you about rebranding the boring slash mucky middle. I talked about that a lot on the Everyday Fi podcast with Megan Combs, episode 6, The Middle Path of Fi, and I will link to that in the show notes." And then he continues, "Anyway, in your response to your call for suggestions, I think calling it the mindful middle could be a better way to label the phase while striving for Fi while also designing and living your best life. Thanks for putting out great content. Hope to see you at a campfire or another meetup sometime soon, Ryan." Well, Ryan, thanks for submitting that to me or sending me the email. And if you recall, it's funny how these paths cross multiple times. Megan was a co-host with me at Campfire Midwest, and I released that episode. It was episode 14, live from Campfire Mid-Atlantic, and I will put a link to the show notes there. I listened to that episode. It was a very good episode, by the way, the one that Megan interviewed Ryan on, and I think it's definitely worth a listen, and I will also link to that. He talked a little bit about the story of Buddha, which I thought was kind of interesting. So if you're familiar, Buddha was a prince prior to becoming the Buddha. He was a prince who was protected from all things bad in life. He lived a very sheltered life. And then eventually he decided to go out into the real world and experience what the real world was like. And he experienced things like old age, sickness, death, and he also experienced asceticism. Man, that's a tough word. But anyway, that's rigorous fasting and deprivation. So he ended up leaving the palace and living a life of deprivation and realizing ultimately that that was also not a way to seek nirvana or enlightenment. And he realized that there was more of a better path, which was the middle path. And I think that's kind of an interesting analogy because we think of financial independence as being this kind of utopian lifestyle of everything is great, you know, unicorns and rainbows, as Carl on the Mile High Fi podcast likes to refer to it. And that doesn't really exist. And then also there are people that are trying to strive for financial independence through kind of deprivation, really just saving every penny, eating rice and beans, keeping costs down to the lowest possible amount in order to reach FI as quick as possible. And I think many people who try that path also realize that's probably not the best way either. And there is this kind of middle path, which is a life of balance. So I really like the idea of calling it the mindful middle, because in Buddhism, there is the concept of awareness and things like meditation and so forth, but basically being aware of what's going on around you. And I think in the kind of financial independence community, it's a matter of being aware of where your money is going and living a life of balance and thinking about spending in terms of what you value and avoiding things that you don't value, for example. So this middle path, and of course, being Mark's money mind, I think I do gravitate to the word mindful. So Ryan, thanks for suggesting that. But for me, and Ryan, obviously, I think calling it the mindful middle is a great solution. So it's a way of getting to financial independence at ultimately being aware of everything that you are doing and reaching it through a life of balance. So thank you, Ryan, for submitting that. So I want to give you a little bit of a backstory about Ryan and my interaction in Bali. It's kind of funny. We were at the Phi Freedom Retreat that Amy Minkley puts on in Bali. It was the inaugural event. Both Ryan and I were participants there. Many of us rented scooters. And after the event, we went over to Nusa Lembongan and Nusa Sentikan, and ultimately Nusa Penida, which are three islands off of Bali. And a number of us rented scooters to cruise around. It's the easiest way to get around on these islands and even on Bali itself and in many parts of Bali. So we created, or I created, I guess you would say, the Financial Freedom Motorbike Club or Motorcycle Club. I think I like motorbike better because they're not really motorcycles. Anyway, FFMC. And we have a logo and everything, and it says established in Bali in 2023. We had a group of us that we went from Nusa Lembongan over to Nusa Senigan, and feel free to Google it. It's gorgeous. And there were a number of sites to see, and you ride your scooter over this. It's called the Yellow Bridge. Look it up, Yellow Bridge. Maybe I'll put a link in there to the Yellow Bridge. It's an interesting bridge, very narrow. And you do actually ride your motorbike across, and basically it's open to motorbikes and people, but that's it. So anyway, we were in this group of, I don't know, I want to say there was at least 15 of us, maybe even 20. We were just cruising around Nusa Senigan. Amy was just a super host and showing us around this beautiful island. And there was what we like to call this rival gang that kind of broke off. And Ryan was one of the rival gang members, I guess you would say. And because the island is so small, we would typically end up at these same locations, but coming in two different groups. So we just joked that it was a rival gang. Of course it wasn't. It was just a fun event. But anyway, Ryan was one of those rival gang members of the Financial Freedom Motorbike Club. Anyway, so that's where our paths crossed. And yes, there were about 50 people at the event, and we spent some time together, but not enough time together. So yes, absolutely looking forward to seeing you in the future sometime at one of these other events. And thank you for sending that in. And thank you everyone else for sending in suggestions. There are too many to go through here, but I do appreciate it. And I just wanted to pick out the one that I really felt like represented the mindset of that middle period. So the mindful middle it is, or at least in my book and in Ryan's book. And yeah, jump on over to Everyday Phi podcast and listen to that interview with Megan Combs and Ryan. It's a really good episode. And like I said, you can see it in the show notes. And we will get to our next question. This next email comes from Jyothi. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. Hi, Mark. My name is Jyothi. I first listened to you on Bigger Pockets Money Show. After that, I started following your podcast. Thanks for the wealth of knowledge and wisdom related to personal finance matters. Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. The reason I'm writing this email is to seek your advice related to retirement fund allocation. I'm only asking for your viewpoint as to how to figure out my game plan and educate myself before I consult a financial planner eventually. Here is my situation. I am 53 years old and planning on working for another 7 years. I have a state employer issued pension. I opted for self-managed style plan, which I actively manage my investments and will be able to withdraw a lump sum or get an annuity upon retirement. I have close to $500,000 in my pension plan right now. My husband also works in the same organization, but he has a traditional pension plan. He still has 10 years to retire. Based on his current salary, he will probably get close to $100,000 in pension per year by the time he retires. With his pension income, I may not need to touch my retirement funds. My question is how best I can manage my pension funds at retirement. His is not a 401k or 401a. I would like to withdraw them in a lump sum. What are my options if I do the lump sum withdrawal? I would like to eventually pass it on to my son without any tax burden. I appreciate your input. Thank you, Jyothi. Well, thank you for submitting that. And first, I do want to say that I am not giving advice on this show. This is just for education and entertainment purposes only, but I can discuss things in such a way that hopefully help you formulate your own opinion on how to go about this, or at least how to think about this. So here's what I would consider. First of all, it sounds like your husband's pension is pretty substantial, which is awesome. And I would also look to see if either of you or both of you have Social Security coming to you at some point in the future, because that definitely can play into your plan. But let's assume that the pension and any future Social Security covers all of your costs. For example, as you implied here, that you may not need to touch your retirement funds. So in that case, maybe it does make more sense to take the lump sum option. And typically, the actuaries behind these pension plans are pretty good at estimating what the appropriate lump sum amount would be for someone who would be of average life expectancy. So generally, it should be a relative toss-up between the lump sum and the pension. And it's more of a decision on, do you want a lifetime stream of income or do you want a lump sum amount that you can use in any way you choose? Now, if you have enough income from pension and or Social Security that covers all of your costs, in that case, additional lifetime income in the form of an annuity for you may not be the preferred choice. But you can also do some math using sites like immediateannuities.com to basically figure out what would it cost you to buy an annuity stream equivalent to whatever the pension would pay out. And you could see what it would cost you in dollars, for example, and see if the lump sum is reasonable, the one that they offer. But again, that would come close to the time when the lump sum is available or the pension decision is upon you. So let's say you decide to take the lump sum and you're trying to pass it on to your son without any tax burden. Now, typically what will happen is that because the pension is effectively tax deferred funds, those lump sum dollars will typically go into a traditional IRA or IRA rollover, subject to tax whenever you withdraw those funds, whether it's you or an inheritor, for example. And if, for instance, you were to leave the money in that inherited IRA and leave it to your son, eventually you yourself may need to take required minimum distributions. And let's say you're 53, so most likely it would be not until age 75. But at age 75, you would need to start taking required minimum distributions from that account, and those would be taxable. But if for some reason you were to decease before age 75 and that account was left to your son, for example, he would then need to distribute all of the funds in that account within a 10-year period, and those would be taxable, that distribution. Now, if it's after you have started your required minimum distributions, he would, according to current legislation, and again, it's a little bit gray because they're still trying to figure out the rules around this, and this is all a result of the SECURE Act, but he may have to take distributions in years 1 through 9 and then completely take all of the distributions by year 10, for example. But he may want to do it over the course of 10 years anyway from a tax standpoint. Now, if you want to try to pass on these funds to your son without any tax burden, you would want to try to get it ultimately into a Roth IRA. And the way you can do that is you can do Roth conversion. So let's say you've taken this lump sum, you've rolled it over into an IRA, and now it's in your possession. And maybe your son is the beneficiary because right now the money is in there and it's intended for him, as you mentioned. If something were to happen to you, yes, he would have to withdraw those funds within 10 years and pay tax, but you could consider converting those funds. And most likely you would want to do it over time and not in 1 year alone for tax reasons. And this is a reason to consult a tax professional and figure out what tax bracket you're in. How much room do you want to do conversions within specific tax brackets, for example? So over the course of a number of years, you could do conversions, which is basically moving the money from a traditional IRA, a rollover IRA, to your Roth IRA or a newly created Roth IRA, and doing it over the course of a handful of years. And yes, you would pay tax on those conversions. It is a taxable event. If, let's say, over the course of a number of years, you were able to convert the entire balance over to the Roth IRA, and then it was left to your son down the road, then all of those funds in that Roth IRA would have already been taxed, so he would not be subject to tax on those funds. However, he would still need to take the money out of that account within a 10-year period as a result of the Secure Act. So he could move it into a savings account, a brokerage account, or whatever, but it would have to come out of that Roth IRA within 10 years. Now, because the Roth IRA has no tax consequences, it might make sense for him to leave it in there for the full 10 years and take it out right at the end of that window. So that's one thing you could do. Now, what you may want to consider is if you were to leave, and this is in the kind of estate planning or tax planning for future generations, maybe it makes sense. Let's say you're in a lower tax bracket than he is down the road when maybe this is getting closer to this money being transferred to him. If he was in a lower tax bracket, it may make more sense to leave it in the traditional or rollover IRA and let him pay the tax at a lower rate than you paying a tax on the conversions at a higher rate, or vice versa. If you're in a lower tax bracket, then he potentially will be. Maybe it makes sense to pay the conversions at your tax rate and leave it to him tax-free in the Roth. So that's kind of ways to think about it. This is where creating a future tax planning process is beneficial. So thinking about not just what are my taxes going to be in this particular year, but what are my lifetime taxes going to look like? And in your case, you're also thinking about what are the taxes for you and your husband, for example, versus what would the taxes be for your son? So that is also a factor in whether to convert or not, and maybe leave the money to your son, even though the tax will be due. But if he's in a lower tax bracket, maybe it makes more sense to leave pre-tax money to him. Anyway, so that's how I would think about it. And yes, having a retirement financial planner, preferably a fee-only planner, fiduciary, help you run through scenarios would be beneficial, and or a tax professional as well. So thank you for sending that in, Jyoti, and I appreciate the email, and I appreciate you listening to the podcast. This next question comes in from Brad. It's quite lengthy, but I'm going to try to get through most of it. I will summarize in certain areas where I think it's not as relevant, for example, or at least I don't need to divulge all of the details. He says, "Hey, Mark, I've been enjoying listening to your podcast since the beginning and other related FI podcasts such as Choose FI, The Money with Katie Show, and others." Wow, that's nice company to be in. Thank you. "At the end of each episode, you invite your listeners to send you questions, and I wanted to take you up on this. You are welcome to consolidate this information as you see fit, but I wanted to give you as many details as possible in hopes of getting a rounded response or starting an ongoing conversation. First, this question is on behalf of my parents' situation, not my own financial situation or FI pursuits, though I would be happy to discuss this in the future at some point. An objective point of view on my parents' situation would be appreciated. Second, I am looking for guidance on how my parents should best utilize, primarily invest, a small inheritance they recently received. If this were my situation, I feel like I have a good handle on what I would do. Since they are a bit older and technically a few years from retirement, I'm wondering if there are other implications that should be considered as a result. Third, here are a whole bunch of details about my parents' current financial situation. And again, I'm going to summarize a little bit here. They are both age 62. His father works full time, but also does some side jobs to make additional income. And his mom works part time, 10 to 15 hours a week. He lists their income. I don't think that's necessarily relevant to disclose at this point. Their savings, they have a recent inheritance of about $95,000 and some general savings of about $20,000. And then he gives the Social Security information. They are not drawing yet. So the father at age 62 would receive $2,279 a month. And at full retirement age, which would be 67, $3,234. What is not listed here is what he would receive if he delayed all the way to age 70, which is approximately $4,000, which would be 24% larger than the age 67 or full retirement age amount in his situation. And the mom at age 62 would receive $1,027. At age 67, $1,495, and again, an additional 24% if she delayed till age 70. Now, here's the interesting thing about spousal claiming strategies, and this is one of the things I think you ask later, so I do want to address that, and I will get back to that when I finish the email. So they also have a public employee retirement program of about $500 a month, it looks like. Rounded. The father has a pension. It says unknown details at this time from a prior employer. He doesn't imagine this to be much, but he was at the employer for more than 10 years. So definitely something to look into. No other retirement savings that he's aware of. He lists some of their expenses. It looks like they're about 50 to maybe 60,000 a year total in that neighborhood because he says there's some other expenses that aren't accounted for. But let's just call it 50 to 60,000 is their expense situation. He said other information. I recently had them take a Vanguard risk assessment. Results indicated an allocation of 60% bonds, 40% stock. So that's pretty conservative. I had them recently open a high yield savings account to at least take advantage of higher savings interest rates offered. I believe their account is currently earning 4.2%. Yes, that's about the average of most online savings accounts these days. The bulk of the savings referenced above is in this account. He mentions where they live. They live in the Midwest. He says, of average health. They have yet to answer the question of when they would want to need to tap into this inheritance. And his sibling and himself have encouraged them to consider downsizing, but there's no movement on that part. And he said, lastly, here's my simplified recommendation on what they should do, as well as a few questions. I assume this is his recommendation. Assuming they don't need any of the recent inheritance for at least 5 years, invest 40 to 50% in a low cost, you know, total market fund, for example, leave the rest in a high yield savings account, and then potentially move to bonds if rates go down, for example, or use a CD ladder, it says. And I'm summarizing here just so I don't have to go through the entire email. He says, gather additional information on the mysterious pension. Absolutely agree with that. And reevaluate living expenses and reduce where and if possible. Also agree with that. Questions. For any money they decide to invest, should that be via a new IRA, traditional or Roth, or is a brokerage account sufficient? I think the main factor is one, taxes, and two, accessibility, liquidity. What are your thoughts? And he says, as I am younger, I don't have all the details associated with Social Security, so I would be curious to hear your guidance on when they should start drawing, pros and cons, strategy, etc. So I definitely want to address that. And he says, he continues, I recall you mentioning recently that you would recommend delaying Social Security until the max amount, if available, but curious to hear more. From your point of view, what other factors should they be considering, and or other questions I should be asking them to help provide the best guidance? I hope this email finds you well. Thank you for reviewing and considering the above details. I would be happy to discuss further or provide additional color in that regard, Brad. All right. So the first thing I want to talk about is a little bit about Social Security. So Social Security should be viewed as a lifetime stream of income that is adjusted for inflation every year, which most pensions do not have. So it is really the best form of lifetime secure income that you can get. And looking at the two figures here, so I'm looking at the full retirement age numbers, which is age 67. For the father is $3,234, and for the mother is $1,495. Now, when you have a couple, one spouse can claim on the other's record if their own Social Security isn't more than half of the spouse's Social Security. So, for example, in this case, the father has a benefit of $3,234. Half of that would be about $1,600. And so the mother would potentially have the benefit of claiming on the husband's record when he begins to draw, and it would be half of what his amount would be at full retirement age, so $1,600 in this case. But her own benefit is already $1,495 at full retirement age. So the reason I mention that is because you cannot draw a spousal benefit until the other spouse actually starts receiving their own benefit. So in order for that to work, they both need to start drawing. However, if they can, it probably would make most sense, and usually it's the case in a married couple, that the higher earner, if they can afford to, delay until age 70 to get that largest benefit available. And as I said, in this case, it would be a little bit north of $4,000 for the father. And the reason is this, because if the father were to live longer, then obviously he receives his full benefit, his $4,000, because he delayed for the rest of his life. If he were to predecease his spouse, she would then step into his shoes and receive that delayed benefit of up to $4,000 if he delayed all the way to age 70, for example. That's super beneficial when the first person passes away. So that's why it's so important to consider delaying for the higher earner. Now, the downside to that is if that father in this case delayed, then the spousal benefit for the mother wouldn't be available until he started claiming. However, her own benefit is almost half of his anyway. So there really isn't a big detriment for him to delay and for her to claim at an earlier age. Now, there are calculators out there like Open Social Security, and I'll put a link to that. And that's more of a kind of a break-even calculation. But generally, it's probably going to suggest that the higher earner, in this case, the father, delayed at age 70, and then the mother usually would be claiming somewhere around full retirement age. That's usually the recommendation of that software, for example. And that may make a lot of sense. Now, the question is, can they afford to delay that long? Well, if he were to continue to work until age 70, then yeah, probably. Or potentially go part-time. And if they were both part-time and she was claiming at, let's say, full retirement age of 67, could they delay his until age 70? And then therefore, either one of them would benefit regardless of who predeceases the other. And so that's something to look into. Consider, at least. And then the other one, this pension, it didn't say whose it was. I would look into, is there a survivor benefit to that pension, or is it a single life pension? Because I think based on the information you've given, once they are kind of turning on their Social Security or potentially working part-time until that second person delays, the father delays, for example, It looks like they may be able to cover a majority of their expenses, but that's something definitely to math out. But I would say that inheritance and general savings may need to come into play sooner than you think, potentially, unless they're able to really reduce their expenses. And again, it's very limited as to the expenses that you've given me. I don't necessarily see the full picture here, but it's close. It's tight, I would say. And then as far as their, you know, investments go, how to invest it, I can't give advice on this. I can just kind of give you an idea of how to think about things. And in your case, you said they did a risk assessment and it showed 60% bonds, 40% stock, which is pretty conservative and not abnormal for somebody in this situation, I would say. But I would probably caution on the side of keeping those funds safe, because there's something called risk tolerance, which is really the assessment that you did. How much volatility can they tolerate? And then there's risk capacity, which is basically how much can your plan absorb as far as volatility, given that the expenses are relatively close to the identified secure retirement income. That inheritance and savings may need to come into play. And so I would say they have less risk capacity, maybe, than risk tolerance. So I would probably err, personally, if it were me, err on the side of being conservative with those funds to make sure that they were available if needed. And then I just want to make sure I've hit all of the points here. Oh, so, you know, should you put it in an IRA? If they're still working and they have the ability to, and based on the income that you've given me, and I didn't identify it, but basically they're in the 10 and 12% bracket. So there's no huge reason necessarily. It's not like they're in a very high income tax bracket where it makes a lot of sense to defer as much income as possible currently. So yeah, I mean, they could take advantage of a Roth IRA, for example, at age 62, again, provided that they have a Roth that's been open for at least 5 years. They've met the requirement of being able to withdraw that money at any time with no tax or penalty. Certainly the contributions, any conversions, it would just be the earnings, whether they were available. But as long as a Roth was open for at least 5 years, and they've met that rule, they've met the 59 and a half rule and the account being open for 5 years. If not, only the earnings wouldn't be available. So yeah, maybe a Roth could be beneficial, but I really don't think there's a huge advantage at this point for the Roth versus just using a traditional brokerage. So I really don't think you can go wrong in either way because of the tax bracket that they're currently in. I think I've addressed most of the questions you have, but I would say the biggest thing is really try to understand what are their, and hopefully with them, and they can understand this with you, is what are your true run rate expenses, and where is the income going to come to cover those, not just today, but also in the situation where one person predeceases the other, which in most couples, one person is going to pass away before the other. And then that second Social Security is going to go away. That pension may be reduced or even eliminated. So I would want to try to figure out what happens in the case of one person predeceasing the other. Where do they stand at that point? Because I think that is potentially a bigger issue than when they're both alive and potentially working full or part-time and potentially receiving Social Security. So I would say the key items would be, what is the Social Security claiming strategy? Is it covering all of their expenses? If not, what is going to pay for the shortfall? Between the savings and inheritance, there's not a lot of room to cover a lot of shortfall. So I would say trying to get those costs within that, those lifetime stream of income, Social Security and the pensions, would be a primary goal. And so that's kind of how I would think about it. And I wouldn't worry too much about how to invest the money per se. I would say that comes down lower on the list. So hopefully that was helpful. I know that was a long-winded answer, but it was a long question. But thank you, Brad, for sending that in, and I hope that gives you some ideas on how to move forward with this. And I think it's great that you are helping your parents walk through this. They're certainly very lucky to have you help them in this manner. So thanks for sending that in. This next email comes in from Leslie. Hi, Mark. I'm enjoying your content. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. Since Economy 2024, I've confirmed that I've reached FI, worked with Frank V to run the numbers. Coaching from Doc G helped me pull the trigger in informing my employer that I won't be starting any new projects and will separate in the first half of 2025 when existing projects are completed or passed to another staffer. Let me pause there. Congratulations on that. That is awesome. And Frank V, by the way, is Frank Vasquez, who is on a panel with me at Economy. And Doc G is the host of the Earn and Invest podcast. And also, I should mention, Frank Vasquez has his own podcast called Risk Parity Radio. And I continue. I greatly appreciate that you take the time in your podcast to really educate the listener. I've been listening to personal finance podcasts faithfully for the past decade, and too often important account-related details are glossed over. The result is the information is not actionable, so thank you for filling this important need. You asked for listener questions to seed possible future podcast topics. I would appreciate a podcast episode addressing brokerage accounts. I did not come from a wealthy family, and I've only recently reached FI via a federal pension and retirement savings accounts, so brokerage accounts are foreign to me. With the help of an inheritance from my parents, I'm faced with non-retirement savings for the first time in my 61 years. Those funds were received last November, but are still not invested. Some funds were used to bolster my emergency fund, and she mentions the allocations here, but basically some was placed in an online savings account yielding 5%, and then she opened a Schwab brokerage account and deposited the balance. And she says, but I haven't invested it. Meanwhile, the market has been rallying. I'm well-versed in traditional and Roth IRAs, but not brokerage accounts. I don't have a mental framework for how a brokerage account fits into the bigger financial picture. Specific questions I have: what to invest in so I don't end up with dividend distributions or other unexpected or premature tax consequences? What sequence to use brokerage funds versus IRA funds? I understand the fund should be invested a minimum of 1 year so gains have a tax advantage status, but I'm otherwise deer in the headlights. Let me know if you have any questions. Thanks for considering brokerage accounts as a future podcast topic. I suspect I'm not alone in needing guidance on how to think about the role of a brokerage account and different investment considerations versus retirement accounts. Thanks, Leslie. Well, thank you for sending that in, and I will definitely look to potentially have a podcast on this subject of how to use a brokerage account, but I think I can answer a few of the things that you have brought up here. So the best way to think about a brokerage account is, what is the goal for the funds within that account? If you have a goal that's, let's say, a down payment on a house, you could use a brokerage account to accumulate assets for that. Now, if you're going to buy the house within a near-term time frame, you wouldn't want to take investment risk with that, for example, but you could buy things like a money market fund or treasury bills or short-term bond fund or something in that neighborhood for a goal that's 5 years or less. If you have a goal that's longer term, 5 to 10 years, for example, well, that's when you could start considering things like equity funds, and you mentioned not wanting to end up with dividend distributions or other unexpected premature tax consequences. Well, this is where the case for, and in, there are many other cases for this as well, but the case for an index fund makes a lot of sense because index funds tend to be very tax efficient. They don't have a lot of transactions within them that cause capital gains distributions, which are really the unexpected tax consequences for managed mutual funds. The dividend distributions, I wouldn't fear too much about those because dividends are typically going to be qualified dividends and they're going to get preferential tax treatment, just like long-term capital gains, which, as you mentioned, over a year, they get that same tax treatment. So I wouldn't be too concerned about dividend distributions, but I would definitely want to avoid funds that have large capital gains distributions, for example, and those typically will be your managed funds, for example. Index funds tend to be very tax efficient. And also the ETF version, so exchange traded fund version of mutual funds, also tend to be even more tax efficient than the mutual fund version of that same index fund, for example. I'll just use this as an example. You can buy a total market index fund from a variety of companies, Schwab, Vanguard, Fidelity, whomever. Look for ones that have low expense ratios, and typically there will be a mutual fund version and an ETF version. And the mutual fund version, typically the advantage of that is you buy them in dollars and you say, I want to buy $1,000 of XYZ fund, and that trade will go through at the end of the day at whatever the price is at the end of the day. The ETF version is typically sold in shares. So you will say, I want to buy X number of shares at a stated price. You could put a specific price you want to buy it at. And if that price is available throughout the day, you will get that trade at that price. And those are traded throughout the day. That's the main difference. And then mutual funds are slightly less tax efficient than the ETF version, but we're talking a very minute amount of differential, but there is some advantage to an ETF over a mutual fund, for example. But the key with brokerage accounts, I would say, relative to a retirement account. A retirement account, for the most part, you're using it for retirement purposes and you're going to allocate your assets based on that long-term goal many years probably down the road. Now, the brokerage account, typically you're going to use for things that are more near-term in nature. And you also don't have the issue of pulling funds out before age 59 and a half. You referenced your age here. It appears that you're over 59 and a half, so that wouldn't necessarily apply to you. So you could also use your retirement accounts for short-term goals, knowing that that money is available at any time to you. The differences are the tax consequences, and that's where kind of thinking about where do you want certain assets to be. So that's called asset location, and maybe I will get into that in the show about brokerage accounts versus IRAs, for example, because that's where that comes into play. But I wouldn't fear brokerage accounts. I would just view them as a different form of investment account. It just has different tax parameters around it. And you can use it for goals that are not retirement oriented, but you could also use it for retirement oriented goals as well. There's nothing wrong with using a brokerage fund as a retirement account. If, for instance, you are maxing out your retirement accounts and can't put any more money in your retirement account and you want to save even more for retirement, no reason not to use a brokerage account as well. So really, they're just very flexible accounts, and you can pretty much buy almost anything in a brokerage account. And so I would just think of it as, what are the goals that you're trying to satisfy with the money in your brokerage account, and align those investments with the goal that you're trying to achieve in that account. So I think you're doing a great thing based on the information you've given. It sounds like you've made some good choices. And now it's just a matter of putting the money to work in your brokerage account, aligning them with the goals that you're trying to achieve with that account. But thank you for the suggestion. And I will look to potentially have a episode on how to use different accounts, brokerage, retirement accounts, et cetera. We talked about that a little bit on how to fund those accounts in the last episode, but having an episode talking about what to do once you fund accounts is a great idea. So thank you, Leslie, for sending that in. And for the last segment of the show, I wanted to reply to an email that I received, but I can't put my finger on it. Somebody was asking me, what retirement podcast do I respect and listen to myself? I put together a short list here. These are the ones that I listen to every week. And the first one is the Retirement and IRA Show with Jim Saulnier and Chris Stein. It is really in-depth. I would call it a 301 class in retirement planning and IRA discussions. They also start every show with a Social Security question And I really appreciate what Jim and Chris do for education in this space, and I find it highly valuable. The next one I always listen to is the Retirement Planning Education Podcast with Andy Panko. Andy is extremely knowledgeable, and I always learn something when I listen to his show. Another one is the Retirement Answer Man show with Roger Whitney. He is also the founder of the Rock Retirement Club, which I am a member of, and that show addresses a lot of information in the retirement space, but it's a little on the lighter side as far as the in-depthness of, let's say, the Retirement and IRA show and Andy's Retirement Planning Education podcast. And then I always listen to Retirement Starts Today with Benjamin Brandt. It's usually a shorter show, and it's an easy to digest, usually somewhere in the minute 20 to 30 minutes, and frequently is answering questions, and we're talking about an article that was in the, whether it's the advisor space or the financial space. I always find that of interest. And then I really do enjoy listening to Your Money, Your Wealth with Joe Anderson, Al Clopine, and Andy Lask. And that show is kind of fun. They're always doing spitballs. So for me, it's kind of like a game. I like to think, well, how would I answer that question? And so that's a fun one to listen to. So those are the five that I listen to every week. And I respect them all. Of course, I always tell people, as with my own show, the advice or the information you hear on these podcasts is usually very good and well sourced, but it's always good to do your own due diligence. So those are the ones I listen to, and I apologize for not recalling who sent that email in to me, but that is my list. So hopefully that is helpful for you. I will see you next week. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. If you would like me to answer a question on the show, please send it to mark@marksmoneymind.com and put podcast question in the subject line. Let me know your first name, or let me know if you would like to remain anonymous, and also your state of residence if you choose. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next week on the Mark's Money Mind show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. And now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.